Yeah, and that was probably the most miserable, two nights of my life.
Welcome to the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs, Episode 7. I'm Josh Durham.
And I'm Ashley Pace.
Our podcast has been about the great 1990 Burlington Indians, a rookie league baseball team loaded with future major league talent. Our jobs working for the team that summer were among the greatest jobs we've ever had.
It's also been a way for us to determine whether the team's bat boy, who was me, cost one ball player his professional baseball career.
We heard in our last episode that you didn't.
Or even if I did, that ball player, Frank Monastero, doesn't blame me one bit.
And here we are in our last episode. It's kind of hard to believe we've gotten here.
I know, it's really been a good process, and it just seems like we shouldn't be at the end yet, but here we are.
So let's wrap this up. In our last episode, we said this one was going to be like the end of some movies, when you get the updates on whatever became of the characters in the movie.
Former Indians radio announcer Andy Young wrote us when he heard that, and he said he loves those. He said Animal House was probably his favorite.
Yes, Douglas C. Niedermeyer, class of 63, killed in Vietnam by his own troops.
Well, the best place to start is probably the Burlington Indians themselves. Their 35-37 finish in 1990 landed them in sixth place in the league, but manager Dave Keller returned in 1991, and the team finished 40-27, the second best record in the league. They even played in the league championship, but they lost to Pulaski.
The Indians were powered that year by a scrawny kid fresh out of George Washington High School in New York. The kid led the Appalachian League in home runs with 19 and RBIs with 63. He was named the Appalachian League Player of the Year.
That kid was Manny Ramirez. Manny would be called up to Cleveland just 2 years later and hit over 500 home runs in the majors.
Remember Sam Hintz, the high draft pick in 1990, who'd never been out of Wiggins, Mississippi before, never even been on an airplane, and he broke several wood bats in his first game in Burlington? He was also on that 1991 team, and in 1994, he made it to high A ball in Kinston, North Carolina, where he joined forces once again with Dave Keller. The next year, Hintz was with the high A team Bakersfield Blaze out in California, but that was his last year in professional baseball.
You might remember that we interviewed Dave Keller. He said he loved Sammy like a son, that Sammy was one of his favorites. He also said this about him.
He was quiet, but he had a really kind of short sense of humor, but I would love to see him. I have no idea where he is or what he's doing, but just like so many guys off that team, I would love to be able to, you know, see those guys and laugh, kind of reminisce a little bit.
And the way Dave Keller felt about Sam Hintz, it's reciprocal. We finally caught up with Sam recently after months of trying.
I can say my time in Burlington and having to play under him was some of the best times I had, man. You talk about it a lot. When kids like me, young and leaving home and had never left, you know, had never been on an airplane or nothing. And, you know, you meet somebody like him and it makes everything worthwhile, you know. And I can say from my standpoint, one of the best coaches that I had when I played with Dave Keller. Very knowledgeable, you know, about the game. He's a good teacher, and I mean, I had a ball playing for him.
We made sure Sam and Keller know how to get in touch with each other now, so they can laugh and reminisce just like Keller wanted. And maybe this is something they'll talk about.
The funniest story, it's just the way it is. But it's not good or bad, but in the wintertime, we always used to it was our job as managers and coaches to call all of our players that we had the year before. So we called them to keep up on them and see what they were doing in the winter and all that stuff. So I called all of my players. So I called Sammy and I don't remember if this was after the first year in Burlington or not. But I called him, and the phone rang and rang and rang. And then finally somebody answers the phone and goes, "Hello." I said, "Hey, this is Dave Keller. I was I'm looking for Sam Hentz. And I was Sammy's manager in Burlington, North Carolina, and I'd like to talk to him." Oh. And then I hear the phone, because it wasn't a cell phone, I hear the phone get set down on the table like clank, clank on wood. And then all of a sudden I hear the guy go, "Hey, Sam, the phone is for you, man. Sounds like a white guy." And I started laughing. And then Sammy got on the phone and I go, "Hey, what's going on with your friends there, man?" He goes, "What do you mean?" So I tell him the story. He starts laughing. He goes, "Yeah, you know, man, Wiggins, man, there's not a whole lot of white people in Wiggins."
After Burlington, Dave Keller went all over the place. In addition to managing in Kinston, he was a coach for the Hickory Crawdads. He was manager for the South Bend Silverhawks, and he's been a minor league hitting instructor for the Cleveland Indians.
He got to be a bullpen coach for the Indians in the majors. Add to that long list some time as the minor league hitting coordinator for the Chicago Cubs, and then manager of the Cubs minor league team in Daytona.
For the last few years, Keller's been the Latin American field coordinator for the Chicago Cubs. Every time I reached out to him, he always responded, "I'll be in the Dominican for the next 2 weeks."
In episode 6, I finally got the chance to apologize to Frank Monastero for that night in 1990 when I said he needed to get his batting average up. But I wasn't the only one making apologies during this podcast.
That's right. When Dave Keller was in Burlington in that summer of 1990, we thought that that big bear of a man was so old. But as we said in episode 1, he was just 30 years old that summer.
I was 18 that summer. I think Ashley was 16 or 17. And we recalled you as just being this big, intimidating, sort of imposing presence. And I think when we've looked up your age recently, you were only in your 30s that summer, which now that I'm 48, eyeballing 50, is incredibly young. So I just want to apologize for that misimpression we had so many summers ago.
Well, you don't have to apologize. That was my fourth year of managing. So I started managing when I was 26 or 27. But yeah, and you'll figure this out as you get older. You know, you'll go, "Wow, man, I'm that age? Wow. Like, I just turned 60, and I don't feel like I'm 60. I don't act like I'm 60. And so, but there is some days where I wake up and I do feel like I'm 80. But there's most of the days where I wake up and I feel like I'm about 30, 35. So it's a really interesting thought process that we go through. But I appreciate you saying that. You just didn't have to, you didn't have to apologize.
Dave Keller wasn't the only one to wind up with a major league team for a bit. The 1990 Burlington Indians had 7 future major league players on that team. Since baseball came back to Burlington in 1986, none of their teams have had more. For a rookie league team, 7 future major leaguers is pretty extraordinary.
Starting pitcher Steve Gutkowski, who said in episode 3 that people came up with all sorts of creative ways of sleeping on the team bus, he wound up with the Seattle Mariners as a reliever in 1998. He only pitched in 9 games that season, and that was it for his professional career, but he made it. And the first batter he faced in the big leagues was Cal Ripken Jr.
Well, it was pretty nerve-wracking, pretty exciting. I had my mom there, my family there, you know, getting out there and facing, you know, the Iron Man there. It was pretty pretty nervous. I think he almost ended his career, his streak there, a couple of fastballs up and in. Ended up walking him, but then there was a wild pitch out in the bullpen, so they called him back and I ended up popping him out. So it's kind of a weird first batter faced, real, you know, Hall of Famer, and then kind of a weird situation, but at the out.
A wild pitch out in the bullpen? Walk me through that.
One of the balls got loose from somebody warming up, and they called timeout as it was going by on ball four. And he ran to first, and the umpire said that he'd call the, you know, dead, no pitch. And so he came back, and it ended up throwing a high pitch, and he popped it out.
David Bell was another to make it all the way up. Bell joined Burlington in late July, but he only played in 12 games because he got hit by a pitch and broke his wrist. He played 12 seasons in the majors, and he's now the manager for the Cincinnati Reds. But he was part of a wild scene in Game 5 of the 2002 World Series when he was with the San Francisco Giants. Kenny Lofton hit a bases-clearing triple. JT Snow scored, and as Snow crossed the plate, the Giants' bat boy was running out to get the bat.
The play was still live, though, and David Bell was racing around third on his way to home. There could have been a big play at the plate with the bat boy right in the middle of it, but JT Snow scooped up the bat boy and got him out of the way. The bat boy, by the way, was only 3 years old. He was the son of Dusty Baker, the Giants' manager. Ashley, what do you think of that bat boy action?
I think it was very irresponsible of them to have a three-year-old bat boy. I mean, it requires an older person, you know, a little bit more maturity, you know, more skills at knowing when to run out and get the bat, etc. Don't stand on home plate. All of these things that, you know, most normal bat boys know not to do.
Dave Malicki is another Burlington Indian player to have made it, though we've not mentioned him much in our podcast. He broke into the majors with Cleveland in 1992, but he's best known for a start in 97 when he pitched for the Mets. It was the first ever game between the Mets and the Yankees that actually counted, and Malicki threw a complete game shutout for the Mets at Yankee Stadium.
Daryl Whitmore, the two-sport athlete who said I could hula hoop with a Cheerio, he also made it to the majors. He was taken in the 1992 expansion draft by the Florida Marlins, and he was in the majors the next year. He played in the majors for 3 years.
Witt played incredibly hard, and Dave Keller actually said he's never met anyone as competitive as Whitmore was. He approached the game like football, and he was hard-charging on every play.
Do you remember the TV show, The George Michael Sports Machine? Not George Michael the singer, but the longtime sportscaster who had a syndicated sports show. Witt made a catch in 1993 in right field where he toppled over the wall in foul territory. It made the Sports Machine's Plays of the Year in 1993. We've got that video up on our Facebook site. It's about 36 seconds in.
That catch also got him nominated for an ESPY.
Jason Hartke, who joined Burlington right out of high school in the middle of July 1990, and who kept calling Keller coach, also spent 3 seasons in the majors. He made his major league debut in 1996 for the New York Mets. Here's what he said when he joined the team, and legendary manager Bobby Valentine asked if he was ready to play.
Bobby Valentine called me into the manager's office and chatted with him, and he goes, hey, congratulations and this and that. And I go, yeah, it's great. He goes, well, did you get any sleep? I go, man, I was up all night calling people and so forth. And he goes, well, you know, what are you trying to tell me? You can't play? And I go, no, I can absolutely play. You know, I told him, no way, I can definitely play. And he goes, all right, well, you're batting second in between, you know, Lance Johnson and Bernard Gilkey, you know, and both those guys had like great years that year too. So I was hitting second, you know, between those guys. And he goes, oh yeah, by the way, and you know, Greg Maddux is on the mound. So I'm like, okay, here we go. You know, so it was quite a first day. And you know, that first game I ended up going, you know, first at bat, I popped up, which I was just happy I didn't strike out my first at bat, but then I hit doubles in my second and third at bat off of Maddux.
But Alan Embry, Burlington's number one starter in 1990, he'd go on to get a World Series ring. A year or two after Burlington, when Embry was still in the minors, we actually caught up with him as the Kinston Indians rolled through Winston-Salem. Embry traveled with his Sega Genesis, and Ashley and I went back to his hotel room after the game and played Madden football. I thought I was pretty good at that game, but Alan Embry absolutely crushed me. Anyway, in 1992, Embry went from A-ball to AA to the majors. I asked him what it was like to find out that he was moving up to the big leagues.
Oh, you can't is indescribable. I was pitching against Double A Binghamton in the playoffs, first inning, and I see somebody go down to start warming up while I'm pitching. I think I walked two guys or something like that. And he comes out to the mound, and I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, you stink today. Go see if you can get somebody out in the big leagues. And I just about lost it on the mound. So he had a big grin on his face. I guess everybody in the ballpark knew I was going up but me.
And then you pull you out, and you just walk off floating on a cloud at that point?
Yeah, you're numb. You don't know. I didn't know how to act even when I got into the dugout and everybody was congratulating me. Then I called my mom and my dad, you know. See, a week later, I was pitching against the world champion Toronto Blue Jays in the Sky Dome.
Embry started having arm trouble at the end of the 92 season, and in 1993, he found out that he needed Tommy John surgery, which he described as being a year of hell and involving a lot of questions.
You will question yourself, did surgery take? Will my fastball come back? Am I going to play again? Do I need to think of other avenues, which before I'd never done? It was, I'm going to be a big leaguer, and that's how it goes. That, when Superman runs into a little bit of kryptonite, it changes things a little bit.
He made it back, though, and he was on the 1995 Indians team that made it to the World Series that year. They lost that series, though, to the Atlanta Braves, 4-2. Alan Embry would wind up with the Boston Red Sox. In 2003, they faced the Yankees for the American League Championship. If you remember the bench-clearing brawl where Pedro Martinez sidestepped a charging 72-year-old Don Zimmer and threw Zimmer to the ground, that was that 2003 series. The series went to a Game 7, and the Red Sox had a 4-0 early lead in that game, but they couldn't hold on.
That was the game where Aaron Boone hit a game-winning home run in the bottom of the 11th to send the Yankees to the World Series.
Aaron effing Boone. That's still a pretty common refrain around Boston, though they don't censor themselves. The Red Sox got their payback the next year. They were down 3-0 against the Yankees in the 2004 American League Championship Series. No team had ever come back from 3-0 to win any kind of playoff series. I asked Alan Embry what the team's mindset was at that time.
Well, we've won 4 in a row this season, and we've won 4 in a row against the Yankees. That's what we said. Nobody was upset down 0-3. We had 25 guys in that clubhouse that believed in each other and didn't care what anybody else thought about us. We blocked out the outside world for the month of October, and we came out on top.
They did come back. They tied the series and forced a Game 7. On October 20th, 2004, up 10-3 against the Yankees in Game 7, Alan Embry was on the mound for the Red Sox. He got Ruben Sierra to ground out for the final out, and the Red Sox were on their way to the World Series.
Slow motion. It's the little kid in the backyard. When you throw the ball up in the air and you hit it, or you're throwing it against a wall, you play that little World Series game in your head several times. It's a feeling. It's a kid moment. It's the only way to describe it. And then a euphoric moment.
Check out our Facebook page. We've got the clip from when the Red Sox closed it out against the Yankees. And there's our guy, Alan Embry, on the mound.
They faced St. Louis in the World Series, but that series wasn't nearly as exciting. The Red Sox swept the Cardinals in 4. It was the Red Sox' first title since 1918.
Well, the series was over before it started. No offense to any Cardinal fans, but it was boring compared to what we just went through. We knew whoever we were going to play, it didn't matter if it was going to be the Astros that year or it was going to be the Cardinals that year. If whoever we played after that New York series was in trouble.
Embry would go on to pitch for a few more years. He thought about retiring in 2009, but on July 10th, 2009, He took a line drive off of his leg, breaking his right tibia. As he was being taken off the field on a cart, he knew he was going to battle back and to make it back to the big leagues. With a titanium rod in his leg, he rehabbed and got called up by the Red Sox the next year, but he didn't appear in any games. He wound up in the White Sox organization later that season, and he pitched several games for the Charlotte Knights before calling it quits.
He still got the titanium rod in his leg from the surgery, and he still got something else, his fastball.
And are you still carrying titanium in that leg?
Yeah. But I can also still throw 92 to 94.
Get out.
No problem.
Well, when did you last do that?
Last year. It hurts to do it now. I'm not saying that. I can do it once.
And here's a bit of trivia we're still trying to verify, though. Embry said someone told him once that he and Ellis Burke have the record for most ballparks played in. But like we said, we're still trying to verify that one.
As we said, seven players from that 1990 team made it all the way to the majors. But that means a lot more didn't make it. Remember Mike Pincus, the getaway driver for the barroom brawl in Elon? The guy who thought for one shining moment that he had Jim Thome beat for the starting job at third? He was playing for a single-A team in Columbus, Georgia the following season.
Yeah, so I was, I can't remember where we were. I think it was in South Carolina somewhere. I think it was South Carolina, turning a double play one night. Guy got kind of underneath me, and I was just trying to, I was playing second base, and I couldn't get out of the play fast enough. I kind of got up in the air and tore my ACL.
He spent a lot of time in Cleveland rehabbing, and as rehabbing goes, it wasn't that bad. A car would pick him up at his hotel, he'd rehab at the Cleveland Clinic, and then a car would take him over to the stadium where he'd hang out with the Cleveland Indians in the dugout, and then he'd sit in the stands and watch the games. Not a bad rehab gig.
He got cut right before spring training in 1992, though, and he went back home to Florida and joined the coaching staff at his alma mater, Stetson University.
He then moved out to the San Diego area and started a business, but he couldn't resist the call of sports. When interviews with the Padres and Chargers didn't pan out, he hooked on with some golf companies. He's now the general manager for media with the PGA Tour. Advertising, sponsorships, social media, anything dealing with golf and the media, Mike Pincus is right there in the thick of it.
Dino Filial, we mentioned that he was another two-sport athlete who joined the 1990 Burlington Indians in July of that year. He wound up playing with the Panthers and Saints as a kick returner and running back.
Jeff Brohm was another of the two-sport athletes. He left the 1990 Burlington Indians at the end of July to go back to Louisville to play football, and he eventually gave up baseball altogether. He made it with the Redskins and Chargers, though he didn't play in any games. Then on October 27th, 1996, he's with the San Francisco 49ers as the third-string backup. They're playing against the Houston Oilers in the Astrodome. Their second-string quarterback, Elvis Gerback, was already hurt, and their starter, Steve Young, got hurt during the game. So in comes Brohm.
You know, it was a great experience, actually. I had kind of come in the league and was a backup quarterback there for a couple years and just happened to be somewhere at the right time where Steve Young had gotten hurt in the game. Our backup quarterback, I think, had gotten hurt the week before in Elvis Gerback, so I was the next man up. And fortunately for me, for the 49ers, we were 5-2. We were playing Houston, who was actually 5-2 and leading the division, and this was an important game. And, good things happened. We found a way to win. I threw a touchdown pass to Terrell Owens to kind of give us the lead. Terrell Owens, it was his first touchdown catch ever in the NFL. So it was a lot of fun. It was a game I'll remember for a long time.
He says that was Terrell Owens' first TD catch, but our research shows that T.O. actually caught one the week before. In any event, it's awesome that two former members of the 1990 Burlington Indians went on to play in the NFL.
Brohm would also play in the XFL for the Orlando Rage in 2001. He made the All-XFL team that year, but ended his season earlier with a shoulder injury. He's now the head football coach for the Purdue Boilermakers. We've got another video on our Facebook page you'll definitely want to check out. It's of Jeff Brohm playing for the Rage and taking a monstrous hit in the XFL and then bouncing back the following week. It's a great video.
I know, it really is. He probably shouldn't have been playing, I'm guessing. Tracy Sanders played for 10 years trying to make it. He was the guy who signed for a 6-cent roast beef and a Coke from Subway. He's also the one who gave us that great bucket of ass comment. He made it up to AAA, but that was as high as he made it. He never got called up. We tried reaching out to him, but we could never make contact. He's now with the Frozen Ropes Baseball Academy in San Diego. There's a great YouTube video of him showing off a batting drill from 6 years ago. Watch that video. He's got that great accent. Imagine that guy from Dallas, North Carolina, all the way out there in California.
1990 was the last year for Roberto Jimenez, our favorite catcher. He hit .241 that year with 7 doubles, but he wasn't brought back. We've tried to find him like crazy, but we haven't yet been successful.
Alan Walden was the number 2 pitcher behind Alan Embry in 1990, and he and Embry were among the league leaders in earned run average. Remember, Walden was the guy who said he was going after Greg Zahn if something broke out between the Indians and the Bluefield Orioles.
The following spring training, he got really messed up in a jet ski accident. Someone said that he looked like Cyclops. One of those. I mean, you can picture a jet ski accident. It's not a good thing. And I think the jet ski kicked up and he got hurt pretty good.
That was Andy Young. Dave Keller also remembers that.
He had a situation where we had instructional league in St. Petersburg, Florida, in the fall, and we had every Sunday off. Well, he went out jet skiing in the bay on a Sunday and hit a wave, and the wave knocked him off his jet ski, and then the jet ski ran right over the top of him and totally just crushed his nose. And he had a broken nose, and he's lucky that he didn't get hurt worse. But I thought he had a chance to be a pretty good pitcher. I think, you know, later on he started having some arm problems, and that might have cut his career a little bit short.
Walden never made it out of A-ball, though, and 1992 was his final year in the pros.
Remember Tony Tillman, the relief pitcher who was named the team's most popular player and the one who first told us about the barroom brawl in Elon? The one whose nickname was Snake because he snaked away wins from the starting pitchers? His professional baseball career started to come undone in the final days of spring training in 1991.
2 days left in spring training and I was supposed to go to Kinston. And me and Alan, you know, we always played catch together, you know, warming your arms up.
Right.
And it was so boring because you do the same stuff every day. You know, him and I would, like, throw a curveball and not tell you it's coming. Or he had that split finger he threw that would eat my ankles up. And he wouldn't tell me it was coming. And stuff like that, you know, just to spice it up a little bit. I threw a knuckleball, and he reached up to grab it, like, above his head, and it hit him in the knee. And I didn't know Don Chidi was sitting behind me. And he said, can you throw that off mound for strikes? I had no clue. So that day they put me in a simulated game with double and triple A guys, and I struck 10 out of 12 out throwing nothing but knuckleball.
The next day, Tillman went to look at the assignments to see where he was being sent in the minors, and he didn't see his name anywhere on the list. He was being sent to extended spring training to work on that knuckleball. He went into the coach's office to ask them to reconsider. He said he didn't want to become a knuckleball pitcher. Maybe he could add it, but he could throw hard, and that's how he wanted to play. But the coach insisted, so Tillman went.
He worked there for weeks, and he eventually got to head to Watertown, which was A-ball. He was warming up there when he got called into the manager's office and released.
When he released me in that trailer in Watertown, he goes, you can stay here, I will fly home. I said, I want to go home like right now. I can't stay here and watch him play. If I can't play, I want to go home, get on the plane. So he called, and he said, 8 o'clock in the morning. I said, okay. And I turned, and I shook his hand, and I walked I opened the door and I walked down those metal steps. And when I hit the ground, I looked to my right and there was a guy coming, a player. And I said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I'm Tony Tillman. He goes, "Hey," I can't remember his name. He said, "Left-handed pitcher, Texas." So they were without me for no time, half a second.
Tillman went back to college at UNC Wilmington and had a choice of jobs. He could either become a roofer or become a bouncer. He said he became a bouncer and within the span of 2 weeks went from people wanting his autograph to people wanting to beat him up. And these years later, he said if he had it to do all over again, he never would have objected to the knuckleball plan. It probably made folks mad. He said he should have just put on his uniform and kept his mouth shut.
These days, Tillman is back home in North Carolina running a family business. Who knows what his baseball career might have been if he'd had it to do over again. Far more players don't make it than those who do. As Vince Elsier said last episode, that's just the nature of the beast. Stan Hilton, the pitching coach who aimed the radar gun at the team bus in 1990, he coached off and on in the minors for years. He now works with a Texas school district as an aide for special education students and students with autism. And he, of course, still works with pitchers on the side. He remains to this day the highest draft pick ever out of Baylor University.
Andy Young, the radio announcer, went all over the place. Before Burlington, he'd been all over the place, too. Alaska working for a summer collegiate team. Durham with the Bulls. Then the Peace Corps in Guatemala. Then the summer of 1990 in Burlington. Then Vero Beach, Burlington again, Montana, Raleigh, Portland, Maine. And then he had an idea to become a teacher, which he'd had that idea for a long time, and it really started to take a hold. He's now a high school English teacher in Kennebunkport, Maine, and a contributing columnist for various newspapers in that area.
Front office employee Tripp Durham, my older brother, the one who'd been there for the longest professional baseball game a few years earlier, he's also enjoyed a long career in minor league and college athletics. He moved up to Winston-Salem and worked for the single-A Winston-Salem Spirits. He spent years as an associate athletics director at Elon, overseeing their transition from the Fighting Christians to the Phoenix, and for 10 years has had his own sports consulting business. He works with various colleges across the country, helping them out on marketing, sponsorships, and game day operations. Check them out. It's 2D Consulting. And he's also the public address announcer at the most famous college basketball venue in the country, Cameron Indoor Stadium. If you ever catch a home Duke game on TV, you can sometimes hear Tripp in the background. Some have called him the voice of Cameron, but he doesn't like that title. He says he's just one of many voices in that hallowed arena.
Remember Dave Burke, the college intern who gave me a piece of bologna and a beer during lunch at the end of the 1990 season? Burke came back to Burlington in 1991, and since then he's had front office and GM roles with minor league teams across the country. He's currently the VP of sales for the Akron Rubber Ducks, the AA affiliate of the Cleveland Indians. He's carried something from 1990 to so many of the places he's been.
You know what's funny was I still have, to this day, an 8.5 by 11 photo. Someone took a photo of me lining the field in Burlington in 1990. And I still have that picture framed in my house. And I used to have it on my desk. I was a general manager in New York and in Texas and Florida. And people were like, "Dave, when was that?" And I was like, "It was my first year in baseball. I was lining the field." You could see the actual field liner was old school. So it was one that you had to stick your hand in there to loosen up all the chalk so you can actually spray a straight line. And I said, "You know what? You always got to remember your roots, and that's what keeps me humble."
That picture is on our Facebook page.
John Brown, who was the general manager for that 1990 Burlington team, is now semi-retired after spending years with the Chicago White Sox, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, and even a chief marketing officer role with the Columbus Blue Jackets in the National Hockey League. He sums up pretty well how we all feel about our time working for the Burlington Indians.
None of us were getting rich working there, but we all loved it. When I look at back at my career and I think about, you know, all the various things that I've been fortunate enough to do, I mean, some of my best memories are in Burlington and the friendships that I made, the people that I hung out with, and glad my life's path took me that way. And
one of his greatest accomplishments actually occurred in Burlington. When Major League Baseball considers eliminating dozens of teams at the lowest levels of the minors, so much will be lost. The pride of small towns across the country, the stories we've discussed in our podcast about road trips on broken down buses, the team bonding, the adventures and misadventures, all that will be lost, as will stories like this from John Brown. This kind of magic is much more likely to happen in a small town.
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. So when I was in Burlington, I was, can't remember if it was my first year or second year of being with the team, but one day it was in the off season and there was a knock on our office door and I opened it up and there was a man standing there and he introduced himself. His name was Richard Farrington. And we got to talking and Richard shared with me that he was kind of semi-retired, had a retail background and got to know him a little bit and ended up hiring Richard to be the person to kind of run our little team store that we had in the ballpark. And meanwhile, while I was doing that every day, I would take a drive down the street to CCB, Central Carolina Bank, to make our daily deposits for the bank. And I always noticed there was this attractive young lady at one of the teller windows who I started to get to know. And over time, it turned out that the attractive young lady was actually Richard's daughter and ended up meeting Ann. And we didn't really start dating until, probably only about, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 months before I actually left Burlington. We knew each other. We were always friendly to each other. And then as time went on, I think initially she was actually trying to set me up with one of her friends. And that friend canceled, and we ended up going to a Durham Bulls game together, and the rest is history.
As for Ashley and me, well, we came back to work for the Indians that next summer. I had the same job filming pitchers and batters, but Ashley took on a new role. He was trying to do what Trip Durham had done years before, staying late into the night to wash the uniforms.
Yeah, and that was probably the most miserable, 2 nights of my life where I stayed washing uniforms, not in an industrial washer and dryer, but just like a washer and dryer you would have in your home. And the dirt wouldn't come out of the uniforms. And I think the first night I finally gave up and I just hung the uniforms back in their lockers. They were still wet. And I remember getting fussed at the next day about that. Finally, after the second night, I couldn't do it. So instead of, you know, being a good employee and going and talking to the GM and saying, you know, hey, this is just not going to work out, I just left a note and that was it.
Obviously, 1991 wasn't nearly as special as 1990.
No, not at all.
And all these years later, I'm now an attorney in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And I work in information technology.
Ashley and I still get together pretty regularly these days, and we always talk about that great summer of 1990. We even wrote a screenplay about it called, appropriately, The Bat Boy. It's a comedy about a career minor league bat boy, somebody in middle age, and he's never had any other job. It'd be perfect for someone like Will Ferrell. So if any of our listeners know his people, have them call us.
If it ever gets made, a lot of the scenes will seem familiar to listeners. There's even a hot dog incident in there.
And speaking of hot dogs, We promised a few more facts about Frank Monastero.
Before we get to that, if you're keeping score, we said there were 7 future major leaguers. We talked about Gajkowski, Malicki, Bell, Hartke, Whitmore, and Embry. But that's 6. The most famous of all the 1990 Burlington Indians turned out to be Jim Thome. Thome spent more than 20 years in the majors. And the man who hit his first professional home run with the Burlington Indians in 1990 would wind up hitting 612 home runs in the major leagues. He ranks 8th all time. And in 2018, he was inducted to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. But he's not the only Hall of Famer from that 1990 Burlington team. Which brings us back to Frank Monastero. In episode 6, we talked about the great success that Frank had playing in the Perkiomen Valley Twilight League. Frank racked up various league honors and a number of league championships. And in 2014, Frank Monastero was inducted into the Perky League Hall of Fame.
He's running the Diamond Baseball Academy in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. He's married, and he's got 3 kids about whom he is extremely proud. Things turned out more than okay for Frank Monastero.
I've been blessed. There's no doubt about it. I've been blessed.
Remember the kid in that team picture on the front row with his whole life in front of him? He definitely had every reason for that great big smile.
Oh, when you were young, when you were so sweet, oh, nobody could compete with your smile. When your smile shines like the sun.
So that's it. That's the ball game, folks.
We started this podcast as a way to answer the question that we've been wondering about for decades. Did Ashley Pace, the bat boy for the 1990 Burlington Indians, cost Frank Monastero his baseball career?
And it doesn't look like I did, thankfully. We also knew we'd have a great time tracking down players and staff from that team. But what we couldn't imagine is how much it would mean to some of them. Putting Sam Hintz back in touch with Dave Keller has been a great bonus. Frank Monastero has said he's enjoyed listening and that this is outstanding. And Tony Tillman texted me just a few days ago. He said 1990 was such a special time in his life, and this podcast has helped him reconnect with so many folks he thought he'd never see or hear from again. He said he couldn't thank us enough. That definitely makes it all worth it.
The mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs was created, written, recorded, edited, and produced by us, Josh Durham and Ashley Pace. But we have special thanks to give to a number of people, including my brother Tripp, who's been a huge champion of this effort of ours. He helped us get those summer jobs 30 years ago, and he helped track down a number of the folks that we've talked to. He also took the picture that serves as our artwork. That's the corridor where Ashley Pace got busted running hot dogs in 1990.
We also want to thank all the players and staff and others we talked to, and Andy Young for all his great notes and responsiveness to every question we've had along the way.
I also want to thank Rob Ingalls at Law Pods in Charlotte. Rob's an attorney turned podcast guru, and he was very kind to give us some tips as we got this project started.
We also want to thank the band Cabinet from Pennsylvania. They were incredibly kind to lend us their library to do with it as we wished. Our podcast just wouldn't have sounded the same without them. Make sure to check them out at cabinetmusic.com and on Instagram at cabinetmusic. And, of course, thanks to Frank Monastero for being such a good sport.
And finally, thanks to all of you, our listeners. We've loved all the feedback we've gotten, and it's been a real joy to give this story to you. And we hope you'll rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And tell your friends about us. Give us a shout out on social media so others can share in the fun. And if you're ever in Burlington, North Carolina, definitely stop by Burlington Athletic Stadium. Head over to the end of the grandstand on the third base side and peek in through the gate into the corridor. That's where it all happened.
And make sure you hit the subscribe button or follow us on Facebook or Instagram. It's entirely possible we'll come out with some extra innings in the future. Maybe an update on contraction. Or maybe Jim Thome will finally respond to any number of the thousands of ways we've tried to contact him. We might even have a reunion episode with the players we've talked about. A few of them have brought it up. Remember when Frank Monastero was describing the meet and greet at Applebee's, the one where no one came up for an autograph? We told Frank we might record that episode there.
I'd go in a heartbeat. That'd be fun. That was a good group. That was, like I said, if I can still remember some things 30 plus years later, that, you know, those guys had a they had an impact on my life. They really did.
As for Josh and me, we couldn't agree more.
Time.